time for Sports Lit 101 as Bruce Pratt joins us dancing in his home studio in Swanville, I'm sure.
I would be if I could use my air conditioning, but since at the moment I have to have my heat pump serviced, I'm not dancing up here.
Oh man. No AC. Well, better today than a couple of days ago, I guess.
Oh, Lord, yes. And I probably could have taken this whole rig downstairs, but it seemed like, I'll just tough it out. It's downtown. We're tough. We can deal with this.
There you go. I like that. I like that, the spirit, that approach to the world that will serve us well.
It will. And, you know, it's sort of the spirit of this book in a way. As you mentioned, by Lawrence S. Ritter, who was for years a guy you'd see on New York television talking about financial things, because he was the chairman of the finance department at the Graduate School of Business at NYU. And he had also collaborated on some baseball books. But he was a guy that I'd occasionally see on TV, you know, the way, what was the guy who used to be on Wall Street Week, Rukeyser, people like that they talked to that knew about those things. And when this book came out, I remember somebody saying, you know, you should read this book. And, it's, you know, I don't know. I didn't. But what's interesting about, the reason I'm talking about Ritter first, is that he was born in 1922 and he died in 2004. So he saw a lot of the golden age of baseball. Now, he missed the really early 1900 stuff, but he's somebody who saw, you know, Ruth through Mantle, through Mays, through, you know, you name it, after that up until the 2000s. And what he set out to do was to allow the great old ball players who were still alive in the mid-1960s, and most of these guys were in their 80s, some in their 90s at this point, to tell their story about baseball in its early days. But he did something no one else did. We don't know what the questions were he asked these guys. All we know is what they had to say, because when he travels his 75,000 miles by car to interview the 22 or 23 ball players that he interviewed, and they were some of the greats of all time, from Rube Marquardt to Sam Crawford to Harry Hooper, Joe Wood, Hank Greenberg, Heinie Groh, Lefty O'Doul, you know, I mean, the list goes on. What he did was he sat down with them and he talked to them. But you think about when Brad Balogian was doing Wax Pack, the things he had at his disposal Ritter didn't have. No Google, no way to look people up. And because ball players that old were not members of the major leagues who got pensions, there was no record of where they were. So what Ritter would do is find out the hometown, their original hometown, and then get a phone book and start calling anyone with the same last name, trying to find a relative or of some kind. And he found these ball players pretty much that way. The best story, though, is how he found Sam Crawford, who may have been in the dead ball era the greatest hitter. Just to give you a little idea before I tell you how he found him, he hit 312 major league triples, which is still the record, or at least was a record when the book was reprinted a little while ago. And when you think about that, it's inconceivable the record will be broken, because the closest to him is Willie Mays. Crawford had 312. Mays had 140.
Wow.
In 22 seasons. I mean, when I read that, and this guy was in the dead ball era, so it is possible that balls, you know, were rolling in outfields where they had those really big outfields, and maybe some of those might have been doubles. But even if 100 of them were doubles, he has 70 more than Mays. And Mays was known as one of the great doubles hitters of all time. So the way he found Sam Crawford is really, really amazing. He found Crawford's wife somewhere in California, and he wanted to know if he could talk to Sam. And she basically said, no, he doesn't really do interviews. He just likes hanging out by himself. And so he had heard some rumor of some place he might be. And he said, well, if I were to go somewhere between 125 and 100 and something miles north of here, would I maybe find him? She said, you might. So he drives up the coast of California and he stops in all these towns. And anytime he sees a person who looks like he could be a great old-time ball player, or asks about him. Finally, he asks a guy, he says, can you tell me where I might find Sam Crawford. He says, yeah, I guess I can because I'm him. I don't normally talk to people I like. I got a lot to do, but come on in. So the serendipity in the book is tremendous. But what I really like is there's no editorializing anywhere. It's just what the ball players have to say. So if you want to know whether Ty Cobb was a good guy or a bad guy, or Honus Wagner was was self-indulgent, or you want to know if Ed Rausch was maybe the greatest outfielder of all time, you not only get their own story, but all these guys talk about the others, and they talk about how great they were, and how, and the players that had passed on that they couldn't talk to, that he couldn't talk to at the time, like Ruth, Christy Mathewson, or Cobb, or Hornsby, are all described by the people that both played with them and played against them. And it really makes you, made me remember, and this is why I'd recommend it to people, why I used to love baseball. The way I, every summer night, I wanted to listen or watch a baseball game, and it didn't matter who was playing. That yes, I loved to go see the Yankees, but I also loved to go see the Red Sox, or the Mets, or the Phillies, or the Orioles, or minor league teams, wherever. Because it brings you back to a time when the game was played in about 2 hours, when everybody hustled, pitchers pitched complete games. It's remarkable. But what I found astonishing was, of those 25 players, about half of them were well-educated guys. They'd been to college. They graduated from college. Some were engineers. Some were lawyers. We think of the old-fashioned ball player as a guy who chews tobacco and comes out of the field somewhere because he can hit a ball. It really, you learn about these players in a remarkable and, for me, a unique way.
And if I remember right, as a kid, he recorded all these interviews, because I have a recollection of hearing some of those conversations, some of the voices of these guys that had played, you know, back in the teens.
Yes, he did. That's how he managed to be able to do it, because what he wanted to do was, you know, he did exactly why you're a good interviewer. He'd ask a question clearly. We don't know what the question was. And then, you know, 12 pages later, We don't know the other questions, but we know all the answers. And he did record them on an old reel-to-reel tape recorder. What was pretty interesting is that when in the enlarged later edition in 1984, he talked a little bit about that in the preface. But he said in his original preface, and I thought this was great, "Without implying comparison, I am reminded of Melville's Moby Dick. What is Moby Dick about? It is a book about whaling in the 19th century. Is it a book about whaling in the 19th century? Indeed it is. Probably contains more information on the subject than any learned treatise written before or since. Nevertheless, any schoolboy knows that Moby Dick is not really about whaling. It's about man's hopes, his struggles, his triumphs, and his failures." And that's what the book gives you. I mean, you get guys who had just tragic careers. You get guys that had charmed careers. You get guys who came back from devastating injuries. But through all of it, all you hear is the human side of them. And I would love to find out if you can buy those tapes, because I really like to have them. I've thought about it. But here's the other thing that's interesting. The people who have said this is the greatest or almost greatest book, you've got Stephen Jay Gould, Roger Angel, Nelson Algren, Ted Williams, and Red Barber. Those guys know some baseball. And another thing I thought was interesting was that we talked about Cobb, and you know, you had Learson on to talk about Cobb in a different light than his original biographers. Boy, this goes back and forth between the two positions, which is interesting now.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Bruce.
No, I was done.
I was going to say, what also interesting to me is that Lawrence Ritter comes up in Mitch Nathanson's book about Jim Boughton. Because I think Ritter used to hang around that little tavern in New York where they all gathered, and he was not impressed with Boughton and the way that, well, he didn't offer the reverence to the game of baseball that Ritter thought one ought to have.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, the Lion's Head was indeed, to my way of thinking, the greatest bar I ever used to hang out in. And I didn't hang out in there as much as those guys, because I was playing music and I didn't have that much money. But it was a place where you would get these insane political arguments. You get these insane sports arguments. You know, it might be Jimmy Breslin going against Larry Ritter or whatever, like Pete Hamill, those kind of guys. So if you were a minor fish like me and you sat back and watched this, what I think the thing that Ritter and a lot of the journalists didn't understand was that what Boughton was trying to say is, why do you want to, and this is my take, and I'm trying to speak for anybody else, what is it you want to hide? What part of the truth don't you want people to know? And when you see how some of these players were treated, getting a release or being asked to, or winning a World Series and being told that because they batted 290 instead of 305, they were going to get their pay cut. You know, there's reverence, and then there's the fact that the people have a right to know. And a lot of these ball players were used just like chattel, just like slaves.
Well, it's a wonderful book, and it's such a rare opportunity to hear the stories in the words of those guys that played in the infancy of the game. So if you've never read it, get it. And if you've read it before, yeah, this time of year, always worth. That's one of those that's worth a second read to go back and hear those great stories about, well, the likes of Wahoo, Sam Crawford, and others.
Yeah, I've already reread sections of it just because it. I really wanted to remember exactly, you know, what was said.
Wasn't, if I remember right, because I haven't read it since I think high school, wasn't Fred Merkel one of the guys that he talked to?
Yes. In fact... let's see. I was just on that page. Merkel. Where's Merkel? Oh, no, I don't think he talked to Merkel, but I think what happened was one of the players talked at length about how great Merkel was. That's what it is. Okay. How, because Merkel was dead by then. He tried to talk to him, but he'd already died.
Maybe I think it was Fred Snodgrass.
Yes, it was Fred Snodgrass, and who played from 1908 to 1916.
Yeah, and who had his own mess up in the World Series, dropping a crucial fly ball in the 1912 series.
Right, and then making this incredible catch moments later, which some of the people, the players said was the greatest catch they ever saw. And it didn't change the outcome of the World Series that Snodgrass dropped it, but that's all they remembered about him.
Absolutely. All right. Hey, thank you, Bruce.